whistleblower legislation. What give me your take.
Well, whistleblowing legislation certainly has its merits, because when we talk about corruption, at the end of the day, what we want are eyes. And we have persons working in various institutions and various parts of government who knows the procedures of what should occur and what should not occur. And when they see instances where things occur that may raise a red flag, they don't have the avenue to say something about it, or they don't have the protections that are in place to say something about it. And if we really want to tackle corruption, whistleblowing legislation is something that we should pursue. Offer incentives to persons who bring forward possible information of corruption. Maybe you can get a return on some of the money that has been stolen, for instance. Mm-hmm. You have to offer witness protection initiatives. You have to mm-hmm. offer the legal avenues to protect persons, because we live in a society where there's a lot of silence and a lot of fear. I've heard that for years. I've experienced it for myself. We see things that are wrong and we mm-hmm. say nothing. Mm-hmm. So that's a culture that is there. So how do we break that culture is the question that we have to start asking. And you have to put the institutions in place and the mechanisms in place to protect persons who want to come out and say something. Because at the end of the day, we're saying, you know, that Barbadians are possibly, you know, just going along with the corruption culture. But there are a lot of persons at the same time who don't want to engage in corruption, who sees this thing as a problem, but we're not allowing them to come out and say, hey, I saw such and such happen. So we have to put the things in place that allow people to come out of that fear.
Yeah. I mean, just to be devil's advocate here, there's been quite a lot of work done on whistleblower protection and whistleblower legislation across the Americas, to speak that way. One of the challenges you mentioned is things like witness protection. So if your legitimate witness protection is not working within the country, and you now have a whistleblower who may blow the whistle on a multinational corporation, people who have money to go after that person, etc., and the system isn't working well, then it's going to be a problem. You have issues such as, you mentioned, a reward system for whistleblowers. Should that be the incentive? There's a really interesting debate on whether people should be rewarded for blowing the whistle. And if that is the motivation that people would have, they want to get something out of it. On the flip side, of course, is what happens when you blow the whistle? What happens when you blow the whistle, whether you're a public servant? What kind of protection is there for you as an individual in terms of your employment, security of tenure? What about employment thereafter? If you were to go to another company and that company discover that you blow the whistle on X company, and you're now employed by them, and they know that their practices are questionable, or, you know, what happens? So you see, in a small state, we have to talk about these things. Mm-hmm. It's not as simple as saying these are good things to import, but how do they apply in our circumstance when it's a smaller state and people know each other? So it may not be publicly made public that this person is a whistleblower. But at the same time, somebody can know that somebody can talk, and somebody would, and at the end of the day, they would find out.
This is so interesting. We're gonna come back to this. We got the Bar Association on the line. They want to make a response, but we're coming back to this because this is connecting the dots. Good morning and welcome.
Hi. Good morning. This is Kristen Thurton, the honorary secretary of the bar.
Hi. Good morning, Kristen.
Yes. I heard a comment relative to the compensation fund, and I just wanted to respond in relation to that. The compensation fund is created by the same act of parliament that created Barbados Bar Association. The intention of the fund is to ensure that in any instance where any person is at a loss as a result of the work that an attorney has done, that there is proper compensation for them, or at least some level of compensation there. It is not a situation where that fund was created because we know people will steal. That fund was created in much the way that any other provisions that are made relative to crime are created. A society operates with laws, and you create those laws and create punishments in the event that people commit those offenses. Similarly, this provision is made in the event that attorneys, for example, do take money from their clients or do not pay them money that is due to them, or they misappropriate trust funds and so on. That fund is created to ensure that there is some provision there for those persons, but it's not created on the basis that we assume that persons are definitely going to do that. The second point I wish to make is that the Bar Association has maintained a very firm stance relative to persons who are found to have taken their client's funds. Persons in that position can make a complaint to the disciplinary committee, and once the disciplinary committee is satisfied that that person did in fact misappropriate the funds, the general position that has been taken is that there has been a recommendation either for that person to be disbarred or suspended. And the Bar Association, which is separate and distinct from the disciplinary committee, has often supported, in fact, it has supported that particular stance because that is the most significant breach that can be contemplated for an attorney to commit. Additionally, what is interesting is that most people believe that almost all lawyers engage in this activity. It is a very, very small number of attorneys who have engaged in this type of activity. And that is actually supported by the fact that the majority of the complaints at the Bar Association have nothing to do with misappropriation of funds. The majority of the complaints have to do with attorneys who are not properly communicating with their clients. Their clients are unsure what's happening with their matters, and they become concerned. But it's not a situation where there is some by and large substantial number of attorneys who are engaging in this activity. There are over 800 attorneys that engage in this activity. Sorry, there are over 800 attorneys at the bar.
Oh. You have me there for a moment. You had everybody here there for a moment.
So there are over 800 attorneys at the bar. Whew. I challenge people to call even 5%, 1% of that who engage in this activity. It is just that once it happens, it is obviously highlighted substantially in the newspapers, on the front page, on the back page. That's what happens. We accept that. And one of the panelists noted that there's a code of conduct, and there is a code of conduct. And of course, this type of activity is prohibited. If it occurs, then action is taken. But people, of course, have to make the complaints because we cannot assume that a person has taken money.
I'm sure you are aware of the maybe a cliche, you know, that one is one too much, right? But I think that the issue I think is here is that a lot of people are not aware of what you're talking about. So the communication of this, a lot of Barbadians do not know a lot about procedure and so on. I've become somewhat of a Suno ombudsman in Barbados because people don't know where to turn the procedure. A lot of people are aggrieved, and the aggrieved to me comes more from not getting value for money, more so than money being taken. Almost every day I leave the studio, I collect a pack of numbers from the front desk, and the majority has to do with people who feel as though they're being hard done by their attorneys, and they feel as though there's nothing they can do about it because they go to the bar and they make all these complaints, and notwithstanding anything that you said thus far, they feel as though no satisfaction is brought their way.
I understand that is a substantial problem, and that's something that the bar is taking steps to address. We do try to train our members, particularly in matters of that nature, and especially when persons are being called to the bar. We have meetings with them, and we encourage them to take certain steps to ensure that the service that they provide to their client is worth it. And that's what we want. That's what we want to do. We want to provide that service.
I can tell you one of the other things that I do here in the media, and that is to send people to the Barbados Bar Association. And so that they can see, because people think a lawyer is a lawyer is a lawyer. No, all train in basic law, but they do specialties and specialties in various areas. And when you do that, you are less likely to be duped. I think they're going to the phone book and they'll say any, many, many more, and they'll select a lawyer on that basis. And then there are some lawyers that names tend to, that I hear more than others, you understand? And those people, I should probably be aware of those people to avoid those people. Now, they may not be hardcore evidence where you have to bring disciplinary matters to these people, but I think that people should have an understanding of what they're getting themselves involved in. But with that said, I want to thank you for making the swift response. This is how radio works, and this is really satisfaction of a program like this. So thank you very much, Kristen. All right, thank you. Now, let's go back to this whistleblower legislation before we go back to the lines and the WhatsApp. And that is, when I listen to you, Josh, I appreciate everything you say. And I'm not going to say but, I can say and. And I listen to Devron and I understand that there's, again, we got to connect the dots. Because you talked about getting your hands on information so that you can bring people to account and it's not just accusation. And whistleblower legislation can be that thing where you get that concrete evidence. But on the other end, you're saying, man, you know, people should not be incentivized with the whole idea of money. Although we do it with Crime Stoppers, we do it with immigration, you know, those $75 for...
I think that whistleblower legislation or whistleblower protection is not something that should be done alone. Mm-hmm. I think that there's an entire ecosystem that we have to recognize for corruption to flourish. So coupled with access to information laws, coupled with appropriate anti-corruption measures or institution or agency dealings with anti-corruption agencies, coupled with whistleblower protection. So there's a number of things and appropriate procurement laws. Mm-hmm. So you see, once you have these things in place, you have a framework. Mm-hmm. But to just speak specifically to say that once you have whistleblower protection in place, that all be well, mm-hmm. I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. I don't.
Mm-hmm. In the absence of appropriate FOIA, Freedom of Information Acts, you're going to have some challenges. Mm-hmm. Right? So I think that one, and this is something that is extremely important for smaller states, because you're small and because people know things and know one another, it's important to be transparent. So I think the smaller you are, the more transparent mm-hmm. the government has to be, the private sector has to be, civil society has to be, because people talking. So if they're talking, let them all be on the same page if they're talking. But you cannot say that you're depending on a politician who say that somebody deliver a package by the house and then they get on the campaign trail and say, well, I have this in my possession. No, then we're playing politics with corruption.
Mm-hmm. This one, so tell Josh, it's about morality. I did it and I got promoted to the job in the same company I blew the whistle on.
That's a good company to work.
Let's go back to the line. It's just gone noon in Barbados and across the Eastern Caribbean. Good afternoon and welcome to Brass Tax Sunday. You're on the air.
Good afternoon to you, Corey.
Hey, good afternoon.
How are you doing?
I am fine, thanks. And you?
I'm good. Wonderful, Corey. I'm wonderful. Corey, I want to mention two things and then I want to follow up on a comment made by Crystal that you have in the studio.
Yes, Crystal Howell.
All right, Christopher. Right. Corey, two things. Because in your preamble, mention was made of the awarding of contracts and so on. I've said repeatedly, Corey, in this country, that the time is right for Barbados now to have a contractor general. I've outlined a number of things, Corey, that and I will share with the panelists as to the way forward, which I believe should take place. I don't believe, Corey, for any reason that ministers should be directly involved in the issuing of contracts. I believe that when cabinet makes a decision that a project would be, even if it's part of their manifesto or their policy that they want to undertake a project, that having cabinet decided on it, it should go directly to the office of the contractor general. I believe, Corey, that when that is done...
Okay, pause a minute, mm-hmm. Carla. I want to get the panel take on this, because he can raise a number of points and we can forget. Ministers involved in contracts, what's the best practice that you guys from research?
So best practice is that ministers are not directly involved. Mm-hmm. Typically, you would have a central tenders board, depending on the amount of the contract. It would go to that committee. Then you would have an evaluation committee, etc. There are different types of bids, of course. There's sole select, and then there are competitive bids. Where there's competitive bids, of course, you have multiple persons. And where there's an emergency purpose, or whether you're familiar with a particular contractor, you continue using them in the sole select process. So ministers should not be directly involved in any in the award of any contract. What is important that the caller is mentioning is the role of the contractor general. And I really want to kind of touch a little bit on that quickly. The contractor general has a regulatory function. The contractor general does not issue contracts. The regulatory function is, in fact, to follow the procurement process and to determine whether there were any issues or challenges or breaches. The contractor general is not the person, the contracting agency, to put it this way. It's in fact the particular ministry or state agency that would award and sign off on the contract. So I just want to kind of clarify there that the role is, of the contractor general or regulator is to audit the process. Yes.
Having said that, we can draft our legislation to directly hold the contractor general responsible for the issue of the contracts. Why do I say this, Corey? Now, you must understand, Corey, that in our current system, that the person who sits as the chairman of each board under a minister is also the creature of that particular minister. Therefore, if for any reason that I am desirous of giving Joe Blow a contract, I can whisper in the ears of my chairman and direct that contract to Joe Blow. I'm saying if we take it directly out of the hands and interference of the minister.
Let me ask this though, in terms of, and I understand the contractor general concept and so on, there's this whole idea about the cabinet being the executive, right? And they're making the decisions and they haven't been democratically elected to do so. And that's some of the response I get from some of the persons who have sat in those positions. How do you then deal with that in terms of these things actually starting with a cabinet paper for the actual, you know, need of the particular thing? How would you address that?
But for the purposes of transparency, all I'm saying is that if cabinet has made the decision that we are going to build a five-story building in the Bridgetown port, and every person who sits in cabinet has made that decision, all I'm saying is that once all of the logistics of the building has been concluded by cabinet,
then you cut off from there.
Way forward to the contractor general.
Free enough.
So that there will be no interference by any minister to decide, well, this now falls under my ministry, since that the port is now under my ministry. So I can now size up Joe Blow now and decide that this is where I will take this contract. That's the point I'm making. So I'm saying that all we need to do in making the office of the contractor general, that we so design our legislation to ensure that the contractor general, that the buck will stop at the contractor general in relation to the issuing of contracts. We don't have to follow the model of other countries and the way that they have it. Then we can place the legislation to suit.
So, caller, I just want to also recognize the role of the permanent secretary as the chief accounting officer. And permanent secretaries also have a role in this process. So I think that, yes, we're talking about how best to design, and this is a conversation that has to be, you know, in the public's domain and obviously properly ventilated. But the permanent secretary has a role to play in being able to determine and advise the minister in terms of what contract should go forward and what has been approved. So that the permanent secretary has a role. The tenders committee also has a role. So in terms of whether you're switching from the contractor general to a committee, is the same function there. But the added value of a contractor general is being able to follow the process and to review the process. That's the added value. All the other things that you've outlined exist in the current system where there are committees, etc., etc. But what has to happen is there must be an independent body responsible that can go into any contracts. Now, you may think that government may sign 20, 30 different contracts, but there are a range of contracts that are signed by government. And what you don't want is to have a contractor general that is overburdened with approving contracts for all the ministries and government agencies. What you want is somebody that can say, we have some information here that X or Y is being done, and we can go in, investigate it, and use our resources in a very targeted way. So it's something that we have to obviously discuss moving forward.
Yeah, but I'm happy that you said that, you know, because one of the points I want to also admit is this, and I'm speaking now specifically to large contracts, and that is that I believe that under the contractor general, that whenever large contracts are going to, about to be awarded, that the names of these contractors should be made published, and a breakdown, when the cost is given, that a breakdown of the costing of the contract should also be made published, and that persons who have an issue with the costing of the contract should be given a specific time to challenge it before the start of the contract. Because in the interest of transparency, we cannot be telling our citizens that something will cost $80 million full stop, and no one, apart from any ram shops, can discuss how it can cost $80 million. So that's the point of one. But I want to move on to the other point that, quickly. Now, I heard about the persons who are now a part of participating and wanting to be part of corruption as it relates to various ministries. The point, I made this point before. All the government needs to do in ensuring that they want to collect the revenue is simply this. If we have the licensing authority, or the town plan, let me use the town plan as an instance. And I submit a drawing and recognize that the drawing normally takes 3 months to be approved. A system should be in place that tells me that if I want my drawing back in 7 days or 14 working days, the cost for so-and-so doing is A, B, or C. That cuts out the individual who wants to take $500 from me to get it back to me in 7 days. As simple as that. So government can collect the revenue in those areas. Like, it can go for all government departments where money is handed over the counter. Give the citizens of the country the opportunity that if you want a fast track and fast pace return on whatever it is you are planning for, there are various prices for so doing. Government will collect the revenue and it will cut out those persons who are seeking to go to lunch with other people's money when they come to do business. The last point I want to make is with Crystal. She's spot on. Page 19 of the Public Accounts Committee, Corey, where it says 108 units was offered at a cost at $18 million. A new player came into the market offering to build on the same location 96 units at a cost of $33.7 million. 96. Now, 108 is more than 96. So if 108 can cost 18, I don't see how 96 can cost 33.7. Now, in the absence of checks and balances, Office of Contractor General, these are the things will continue to raise their ugly heads in this country. That is the reason why, if we are serious going forward and they believe that the electorate, now is the time to press and demand for the things that you want, because you've got politicians in the palm of your hands at this stage.
And right. I'm sure if the politicians came forward, that they'll be able to prove that there was no wrongdoing. Mm-hmm. Because we have honorable politicians in this country and they don't do anything wrong.
There's a WhatsApp that says that report has no protection in privilege and its contents are reckless and untrue. Brastats, good afternoon. If you're now joining us, we're looking at corruption and the costs of corruption in Barbados for you Barbadians. And of course, Barbados at the macro level. We are talking with Devron. He is a member of Integrity Group Barbados. And he also has done some research on this and writes in relation to corruption and integrity in Barbados. We have Josh Drayton. He teaches at the, or he has taught at the University of West Indies in Augustan in relation to anti-corruption and similar topics, and he was a director at Transparency International in Trinidad and Tobago chapter. And of course, we have internal audit manager Crystal Howell, well known to you. Brastats, good afternoon. You're on the air. Good afternoon. Welcome to the program. You're on the air.
Okay. I just wanted to congratulate you all on a great discussion. I want to also strongly agree with a lot of the ideas that the previous caller put forward. And I have two related points. One, I think it's important that you all have highlighted the cost of corruption, because I think that's what's stopping us going forward. People are not realizing how corruption is hurting the average person. You know, this is what's, I believe, a strong contributor to our economic situation, and perhaps why people can't get education free anymore. We're now looking at potentially having peer costs for healthcare. You know, it is really at the root of a lot of our problems, and we really need to make people realize that so that we can create the political will, force our politicians to implement. Because really and truthfully, going forward, what we need is the mechanisms to ensure transparency, the mechanisms to ensure that there is no corruption, the mechanisms that improve the, you know, we really need that political will. So my main point here is that in 2008, I voted for the DLP mainly because there were promises in their manifesto that they would implement Freedom of Information Act and the Prevention of Corruption Act. Now, we heard all from that. You can go, it's well documented that former Prime Minister David Thompson and our current Prime Minister strongly arguing for the implementation of these things. The Act was actually passed in Parliament by both houses 2012. And then nothing, it's never been proclaimed, never been brought to law. And why is that? You know, another election is passed, and another 5 years and nothing has happened. And it just makes me frustrated that what is going to happen? We have another election here. If we don't, as a people, kick up the fuss and create the political will to make sure that these things are implemented, nothing is going to happen. So I agree that we need to focus on all the people that are contributing to corruption. But ultimately, it comes down to our leaders, our politicians, to implement these things. And I'm not letting them off the hook. Yes, we need to the root of the problem perhaps is the big money creating it. But the way we go about that and bring in those people to justice is through the proclamation and implementation of Prevention of Corruption Act, Freedom of Information, and increasing the ease of doing business. We must make sure that these things happen now.
Great question. You sent in a WhatsApp.
That's right.
Okay, good. Because I was just about to read your WhatsApp, but you actually have, I can tell the WhatsApp is yours. It came in about 11:30, right?
I suspect so.
I had about three questions for you, but every time I had a question, you just answered it. So I can only ask the panel if they want to interrupt, and or we can just move on to the next caller.
Thank you, Spahn.
All right.
Yeah, and I'm proud that somebody is calling to say that, yeah, politicians must be held to account. And yeah, this is what you promised in the last election. This is excellent.
Yeah, he just spot on. Anyhow, Brastats, good afternoon. You're on the air.
Yes, a very good afternoon, I'm Corey. Yes, I just want to share my little tidbits. Now, I want the role and function of the Auditor General. Having if the Auditor General had discovered any malfeasance or so forth, year after year, is like a recurring decimal point, 3333, if you do your math. It is a thing called recurring that goes off infinity. And we seem to be ad infinitum, keep going on and on and on. They're driving forth late before, and it seems to just routine and not taking the seriousness it does. Why is it? And it begs the question, huh? The Auditor General report cannot be given to the Director of Public Prosecution, who has a distinct separation of power from the political directorate. And anybody can send any information on any corruption, criminal matters to the Director of Public Prosecution directly. You know, why is the Auditor General report there languishing, gathering dust where there's obviously there's a high possibility or likelihood?
You say that anybody can send to the DPP?
Yes. You can say you're free to send.
That would include you, sir. Would that include you, sir?
Members of the public. So I'm asking about the Auditor General report. Why it has not been sent on?
But that's where I'm going, because you should be able to answer that question as a member of the public. Why haven't you sent anything?
Why haven't sent? I'm asking the question. I can't speak to that. I'm asking the question as the role and functioning of the Auditor General report. The frustration. As in the terms of the public's interest, I think the Auditor General report should be acting in the public's interest, thereabouts, and therefore, why has it not gone across?
I blame Crystal because she knows so much about it, and she hasn't said anything to the DPP either.
It's true, you know. But we do have a new DPP, and I'm told that she is very intelligent and a very forceful young woman. So I am hoping that this public appeal, I don't know if this is the right process, because I don't have her number. I'm not that connected, sorry, but I'm hoping that we can have this public appeal now for her to delve in and to give some clarification, because I can't speak to what she can or cannot do, but I would hope that as Kristen called in, that she will also call in to clarify her role for the public, because there's sometimes you get conflicting ideas about what can and cannot happen. So you hear one person saying you could do it this way, and then you hear another, and these are lawyers that you speak to.
And they bring different parts of legislation and law. So it's true.
Me not being a lawyer, I am hoping that the DPP, who would be the best person to say what her role is in this, can explain why the previous office was not able to push things forward. I was told that things were given to the DPP in the past, but things has happened. But we see what the current DPP can do to make sure that this does not happen again and that her office can play a more active role. But I would prefer for her to be able to speak on her own behalf.
And in relation to the DPP, we have to make sure that these organizations and these institutions also are well-funded and well-staffed, because a lot of them will tell you privately that one of the issues is that, you know, we have a staff, a lot of about 20 persons, and we only have about 4. So maybe it's an issue of staffing, and maybe it's an issue of funding, and maybe it may be very well deliberate. Because if you want to get away with corrupt actions, I don't think you would want to put money in the institution that's supposed to enforce or, you know, go after these things. So we have to start asking questions about the funding as well as the independence of these organizations as well and these institutions as well.
All right. Thank you, Carl. This one says, do we still have a rule that says that the tender, when on a tender, the tenders committee is bound to accept the lowest or any other bid? The panel should be reminded that the committee accepting the highest bid does not connote corruption. Equally, in some instances, not having a tenders process does not present corruption either. Brass That Sunday in association with Williams Industries Incorporated.
Now is the time for you to fence your property with galvanized green, white, or brown chain link fencing and our brown band galvanized pole pipes, which are the longest lasting. We will give you a free estimate too on all your fencing materials.
For building supplies, big or small, at Brilliant Metals we have it all. At Brilliant Metals we have it all.
Visit their website at www.williamsmetals.bb.
All right, so 20 minutes after noon, remember we go to the latest from the Starcom Network News just in about 10 minutes or so. But in the meantime, in between time, let's go back over to the telephone lines. Brass, that's good. Afternoon, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon.
Right, yeah. I have to commend you all, as the previous callers did. Really enjoying the discussion. The ventilation certainly was a major issue for us as a country. It has been for some time now. What I wanted to ask, well, it related to the Bar Association spokesperson when she spoke of, in terms of matters coming before the bar with attorneys running off with people's money. While that might not be the situation in terms of being able of saying other than what she has said, I want to raise the whole matter of how they speak to the long turnaround times. So if she says that a high percentage is long turnaround times that attorneys take, my little knowledge of it is that while an attorney is holding funds, and this is in relation to holding a client's funds in an escrow account, I would like if somebody could give clarification, even from the banking community, not just from the legal profession, in terms of how the relationship between the banks and the attorney's work, because I find that a lot, well, I've heard it said that the escrow accounts, basically they don't award any interest to the client because the account isn't the client's account, the account is the attorney's account, it's a professional relationship between the bank and the attorney. So I'd like some clarification about that. And also for the second thing is in terms of the parties that are contesting the elections soon to be called, I've been partially swayed by the rhetoric that, you know, we need experience at such a critical juncture as this. But I just wanted to put it out there. I'm not speaking for any party. I'm just speaking generally for the nation and for us as Barbadians. If we've had 50, 60 years of experience that leaves a whole lot to be desired, what's wrong with self-belief in we the people? Because I think you can say that the people are the, well, in different countries, depending on the system, but the fourth branch of government, and if not the largest branch of government. So in terms of persons in the society who might not have had experience as politicians before, when will they be given a chance?
It all has to do with legislation and how we implement that legislation. The other thing about the interest, I remember hearing last time we had the Bar Association here, they were actually talking about where the interest should go and how they would deal with that. But we'll see if we can get a comment from Kristen even offline, and we'll bring that to you by the end of the show if we have that information. But I'll read these. I'll say, they say, so here's the problem with the corruption legislation and why it will never be passed. When in opposition, I will keep enough noise and call for it. But when I'm in power, I realize that the lack of the legislation benefits me. Therefore, it will never be brought to parliament. Well, it will be proclaimed. It's been brought already. Okay, this one says, I query, the legislation is the proverbial door that politicians want to keep closed. When things like the Auditor General report or the report of the PAC are declared, the politicians try their utmost to hide it. There should and must be consequences, penal and otherwise. Some people, when they have risen to certain standards, they then think the law does not apply to them. We must fix this post haste. Now, there's been a discussion, I think actually have been some law and policy, I think it's the Bahamas, which recently brought some law in relation to in corruption and also the misuse of funds and causing the state funds, where they actually are going to go after the persons in power to recoup it on behalf of the state. I think that that is something that can be a deterrent to corruption and bad decisions, because every bad decision isn't corruption, but I think there's some linkages there.
And that's a very interesting comment, because Crystal mentioned at the beginning of the program that Barbados and Syria were the two countries mm-hmm. that did not ratify the United Nations mm-hmm. Convention Against Corruption. There's a massive section in the United Nations Convention Against Corruption titled Asset Recovery. And a part of that section in asset recovery has to do with the confiscation of assets, proceeds, etc., that have been used in corrupt actions. So at the end of the day, if, in fact, Barbados signed on and Barbados wanted to fully implement, and there's also technical cooperation in the event that Barbados wanted to find out how to do this legally, it exists. But in the absence of that kind of, and we speak about political will all the time, in the absence of that, then we have some challenges. There's another term that is called unjust enrichment or illicit enrichment that exists in the Inter-American Convention Against Corruption, which speaks to the fact that if a person in public life is unable to show his substantial overnight increase in wealth, then that is a criminal offense. So, you know, these are things that we have to look at. And these are,
so the burden of proof is on the individual that are not okay.
Not the state. So cool.
Well, no, you would have done, in terms of measuring political finance indicators in 50 countries. So I want to know, in terms of best practices, where some of these things are done, what kind of success and how smooth is implementation? Does it actually work?
Well, There are a number of things. One is that the political finance is a broad term that is used to speak to election or campaign finance as well as party finance. Now, what's the difference between campaign finance, election finance, and party finance? Campaign finance really speaks to the campaign period. So you would have contributions that are given during that period. Election party finance now, on the other hand, speaks about the entire time of the party. Tenure. Because what you have in some instances is that campaign finance or campaigns may be regulated, mm-hmm. but not the elections. Mm-hmm. In some jurisdictions, you have political parties that are not registered as entities and therefore cannot be regulated. You have individuals who are candidates and they're also their agents. Those are the ones who are regulated. Then in also in other jurisdictions, you have questions about third-party contributions. So take, for example, someone mentioned earlier about the international community. Some countries require that you declare third-party contributions, which would include a trade union giving a political party money, because trade unions finance parties mm-hmm. also, which would also involve the United States giving money to a particular country or particular political party. Mm-hmm. So there are a range of things. I mean, I can go further than that because there are 25 in law indicators that were covered in that and 25 in practice.
We're going to have to come back to more of that because it's time for the latest from the Starcom Network News. And before we break for that, Kristen is saying, you know, client accounts do not accrue interest. No banks will allow that. So there's no interest for the attorney to pay the client. And of course, that also means no interest for attorneys to retain, as some people think. There you have it on Brass Stack Sunday in association with Williams Industries Incorporated.